So for this evening, I'd like to talk a bit about meditation. And particularly, I'd like to talk about how we should stop chasing meditation. We should let meditation come to us. So what do I mean by that? Well, when I was in Sydney recently, one of my Vietnamese supporters told me a story of when he and his friends had just arrived in Australia from Vietnam, and it's got nothing to do with meditation, this story, and he and his friends, they just arrived in Perth, as it happened, and they wanted to visit the city. They were staying somewhere out in the suburbs. They wanted to visit the city, so they went down to the main street to catch a bus. Only one of them spoke any English at all, okay, and he'd been an English teacher in Vietnam. So they went out to catch the bus to go into the city, and they went to the bus stop, but next to the bus stop was a sign, and the sign said, "No standing." So they're like, "What are we supposed to do? We have to stand here to wait for the bus to come, but it says no standing." And if you've just come from Vietnam, you're probably a bit nervous about what the government's going to do if you disobey any of the laws, right? So they thought, oh, well, maybe we'll just walk down to the next bus stop and that'll be right. So they walked down to the next bus stop and, oh, there's another no standing sign. What's going on? So then they went down to the third bus stop and there was a seat there. So, so they can sit down now. So they were fine. So these are the kinds of problems that we get, that language can trap us into. And especially what happens is that we tend to interpret language too literally. And this is something that I've noticed happens a lot in Buddhism. And I think because we're all, I guess, in that kind of situation with regards to Buddhism, that, you know, we're learning a foreign language, whether it mean that literally in terms of learning the Buddhist terms, but just generally speaking, we're learning a new set of ideas and approaches and so on. And always the tendency is to take those things far too literally. Yeah, I don't know if you've ever learned any foreign languages. You know, always the idioms are the hardest things because people get used to using the idioms, like no standing, right, on the side. You don't even think twice about it, right? But then if someone comes along and then they think, well, I'm not allowed to stand here. So I think the same thing tends to happen when we come to meditation. We hear a teaching of Ajahn Chah. So, for example, Ajahn Chah would perhaps describe meditation by saying, we come, we sit down and watch the breath and make our mind peaceful. Right? So it's just a kind of an idiom. It's an expression, the way that he's talked about it in a Thai teaching, and then it's translated into an English teaching, and we say, oh, we have to make our mind peaceful. Right? And then we understand it. We have to make our mind peaceful. Let's make it peaceful. Yeah. Actually, it's just an idiom, and we've taken it far too literally. And this is something that I've been noticing again and again and again when I've been teaching meditation. I think probably the biggest problem with meditation is that we think it's about doing something. We think it's about making our mind peaceful. And I'm astonished. I'm really astonished at how often this comes up. And then I've started to note, I don't know whether it's always been this way or maybe I've just started to notice in the last few months, but even my taxi driver had the same problem. I was caught a taxi back from the airport a couple of weeks ago and we ended up talking about meditation. He's saying, oh yeah, I tried to meditate. Actually, I don't know if he's here tonight. Told him to come to the Buddhist Society. If he's around, I can't see him. Anyway, and he said, oh, I've tried to meditate a few times, but I'm just, I can't stop the, I try to focus my mind and I can't stop the thoughts from coming in. Yeah? And so many people have told me that there's this problem. And so many, and I've even many times, I've given Dhamma talks, meditation talks, specifically on this topic and specifically talking about it, saying don't try to focus, don't try to pay attention, don't try to stop your mind from thinking. Accept, let go, be at peace. And then at the end of it, people will still ask questions and they'll say, but I try to make my mind pay attention to the meditation object and then these thoughts come in and I try to push the thoughts away and it doesn't work. What's happening? So I think it's something that we need to keep on reminding ourselves what actually the process of meditation is all about. And it's not about making your mind peaceful. It's not about, that's just more to doing, more controlling. I think one of the problems about this is that we, when we come to approach Buddhism, we approach it as a subject or something that we have to learn, and so we learn about these kind of ideas and idioms and so on. For example, we hear about a meditation object, right? So you use the word meditation object. The Buddha never used the word meditation object or anything like it. Okay, and that's kind of interesting, isn't it? Yeah, and he didn't really talk about meditation in that kind of way. He would say these are kinds of perceptions that you should develop, right? That's a slightly different way of talking about meditation. In the traditional Theravadan word they use is kamatana, is a word for a meditation object, right? But kamatana also is not used by the Buddha, but kamatana literally means a workplace, right? Kama is your work. Tana is a place, so kamatana is your workplace, right? So that's the place you go to do your work. I was thinking about that. I thought maybe a better word to use would be a kila tana. Yeah, so kila is play. Yeah, so kila tana literally would be a PlayStation. Yeah. So what are the different PlayStations that we have? Yeah. So when you think of something as a meditation object, right, it's almost like it's, you know, it's something, an object, right? It's kind of sits there, it's a thing, and then you have to sort of, what do you do with objects? Well, you do things to them, don't you? It's just somehow it's become externalized, it's become reified. And so we tend to have this approach to meditation where we see it or we think of it as something that has to be mastered, a skill or a method or a technique. Yeah, a technique of meditation, a method of meditation. Again, these are ways of talking about meditation that the Buddha himself didn't use. So you use a technique. It's like you have to master a technique, like you sort of master the technique of wood carving or cooking or something like that. And so this is another technique that you have to master. And so, because we absorb this kind of language, right, which is, you know, found so many times in meditation books and Dhamma books and talks and all of these things, and it sort of we absorb this language often unconsciously, and it frames the way that we meditate. So we shouldn't think that language is unimportant. Actually, language is very, very important. None of us could meditate if we had never heard the word meditation. Right? So the word points you towards the thing and it shapes the way that you experience it. Right? When we hear the words talking about meditation, that will condition the way that we pay attention, the way we use our mind, and will condition what the result of that meditation is. So we should never dismiss these things or regard them as unimportant. On the contrary, they're crucially important. Another one of the big culprits, and I know this is something that Ajahn Brahm talks about quite a lot or from time to time, is in Pali we have the word samadhi, which is the last factor of the Eightfold Path, yeah, samadhi, and almost always is translated as concentration. Yeah, so we say to develop meditation is to develop concentration. Samadhi has precisely nothing whatsoever to do with concentration. They're completely different kinds of ideas. Yeah. And it's a dreadful translation. It's not even a translation. It's just a plucking a word at random that has nothing to do with the actual Indian word samadhi that it's supposed to be translating. Think about this for a minute. What does concentrate mean? What does concentrate mean, right? How do you actually use that in English, in a normal English sense, when you say to concentrate on something? Well, what concentrate means is basically the kids down the back of the class are messing around and not paying attention, and you say, concentrate, right? That's how we use concentration. A concentrate means to make yourself pay attention to something, right, which is intrinsically boring, right? Yeah, if it's fun, you don't have to concentrate. You don't have, you know, kids sitting there watching Star Wars or something like that and say, concentrate, you know? Yeah, or playing on the iPhone or something and say, oh, well, you know, concentrate, pay attention. Right? So to concentrate in English means to make yourself pay attention to something which is intrinsically boring and you'd really rather not be doing it, but you think it's good for you, so you'd better make yourself do it. And so because we've heard that word, this is what meditation is, then we bring that attitude unconsciously. We don't think like that, right? We don't tell ourselves to do that, but it informs the attitude that we have when we come to meditate. And that idea of notion of concentration has nothing whatsoever to do with what samadhi means in Pali. What samadhi means in Buddhism, but also in general, it's an ancient Indian word used in the meditative cultures of different religions, Hinduism and so on. But it always means a very profound sense of a coalescence, the mind coming together as one, a profound experience of unity, dissolution of boundaries, in infinity and of consciousness. At a profound state of stillness and unity in consciousness. And I think you'll all agree that that's really got nothing to do with what the ordinary English word concentration has as we use it in a day-to-day language. So, if we're not going to let language sort of point us in the wrong direction in meditation, well, how do we talk about it? What kinds of attitudes and approaches do we use that's going to be more useful? Now, one of the things that I find people telling me again and again in meditation is this kind of idea that, you know, you have, you know, your meditation is I've got to make myself pay attention to this thing, and when I'm making myself pay attention to this thing, then there are other things coming from outside which are disturbing me, distracting thoughts, and I keep trying to pay attention to that, but instead I look at that, or I look at that, or I look at that, or I don't look at anything, I close my eyes and fall asleep. So notice, and that's how we often think about meditation, right? So notice what's happening in that way of thinking, that there's, first of all, there's an I, right? There's me in here, right? That's a subject. I'm looking at that thing out there, which is separate from me. That's a meditation object. Yeah, so this is what the problem with that idea of object. It assumes that the object is separate from me in the first place. And because it's separate, therefore I have to make myself pay attention to it because it's something different from me. And then there's a third thing, which is out here, which is all the distracting thoughts and so on. Actually, it's much more than a third thing. It's actually the third and fourth and fifth and sixth and seventh and seven thousandths and eighth millionth thing out there, which is trying to stop me from paying attention to this, right? It's a very bizarre way to live your life, frankly. So the secret is, it's all you, right? This is you, and this is you, and this also out here, this is you as well. So if you're thinking that you're kind of start with, you're already divided into all these different bits, and I can't get those bits to do what you want, you've started from the wrong kind of premise. Because we've started thinking about a self in here which is separate from the object out there, and I have to make myself pay attention to that object, but then distracting thoughts and so on come from outside and they make me pay attention to the object because I'm something separate from my thoughts. Yeah? And so we don't taste the taste of water. I just made that bit up. Okay, so what if we were to think about it, instead of thinking of all of those separate bits and how that we can't work to make them fit together, what if we were to think, well, that's just who we are? Okay? Don't get don't get into not self here, right? Forget not self. We're not doing not self now. We're just being normal, okay? We'll do not self later at another time. Just let me use ordinary language, right? It's just who you are, okay? You're just sitting here. You're conscious, you're aware. And that consciousness has different, there's different kind of aspects and different things going on within that sphere of consciousness. And in your just sitting here, there's no kind of great separation between like mind and body or inner and outer and these kinds of things. I mean, we can reflect on those things as being different, but actually in our experience, it's just part of how we experience the world, isn't it, right? We experience our body as being here and, you know, we experience sounds out there and we experience... And so it's just part of that world of experience which is given, right? And this is another... interesting aspect of meditation, which I think is also quite misleading, is we often talk, and I find myself still doing this very often. I'll probably do it many times in this Dhamma talk, but we talk about the present moment, okay? The Buddha never used the word present moment, yeah? Well, mainly because he didn't speak English, okay? But leaving that aside, the Pali word for present moment is Patupanakana. And it's a word we find in the later Buddhist literature. We don't find it at all anywhere in the early Buddhist literature. He never talked about the present moment. He talked about the present, okay? Which is kind of the same, right? But it's also kind of a bit different, isn't it? Yeah? A moment is very tight. A moment, something that's momentary is very small, yeah? Yeah? Whereas the present is kind of a bit, it's a bit broader, yeah? And the great Sri Lankan philosopher David Kalapahana made the distinction. He said that the present moment is like walking on a tightrope, whereas the present is like riding on a camel. Right? So you're like riding on the camel of the present. Yeah. So it's a bit, you can sort of wiggle backwards and forwards, and it's got a bit of breadth to it. Yeah. So I really like the, you know, trying to talk about the present, because also the present is a gift, right? Ah, and that's very important. The present is a gift. That makes all the difference. Instead of thinking that, well, the present is something that I have to sort of hunt down and make myself pay attention to the present moment, which is really hard because my mind's always in the past and the future, the present is just what is given to you. Yeah? So again, you think about that. You know, what happens when on Christmas morning, you know, and you give presents to the kids, do you have to say, pay attention to the present? You know? Stop doing your homework, kids. Now you... may have to make yourself pay attention to the... It's a gift. That's what the world gives you. So we don't have to do anything to get into the present, right? The present moment, if we have to get into the present moment, we're thinking, oh, it's something very specialized, something very difficult. We have to balance on it like we're walking on a tightrope. But the present, that's just what the universe gives us. Thank you for that reminder of impermanence. You have to be a great bodhisattva to do that. Yeah, you have to endure the embarrassment of having your phone go off in the big crowd, and only for the sake of all sentient beings, so we can understand the nature of impermanence. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay, so the present. So imagine that. Imagine if we were to think of meditation rather than of being something very difficult, which we had to learn to very kind of refined way of making ourselves do something. What if we were to think of meditation as just allowing ourselves to be given the present? Isn't that the easiest thing in the world? Everyone thinks meditation's so hard. How's your meditation going? Oh, yeah, it's really hard. Meditation's the easiest thing in the world. You just have to be given a present. The universe is here. It wants you to be aware of it. What's hard is going out of the present moment. Yeah, going into the past and the future. This is hard, right? Calling up, dragging up memories, thinking about them obsessively, making plans, worrying about things. That's really hard work. That's what you have to try so much again and again and again. Just being present, it's easy. Easiest thing in the world. Now, what? So. Think about what we're doing when we're doing meditation. Let's just take the example of breath meditation. Of course, there's many different ways we can meditate, but let's take the example of breath meditation. You know, we think of traditionally, they say, you know, breath meditation is a meditation object. It's something out there. Of course, breath isn't an object. It's not something out there. Breath is part of who you are. Breath is what you do. Yeah, breath isn't a thing. It's not an object. It's what you're doing. It's a rhythm. It's in fact the rhythm of life. Yeah. Now, it's an interesting thing about human, I guess, probably animal physiology as well, is that we tend to be soothed by things that's like a gentle rhythm, don't we? Yeah. So you think of something like, say, you know, when a baby's upset, then crying, and then the mother will pick it up and then sort of gently rock the baby back and forth, yeah? Gently rock back and forth. And there's something about that kind of rhythm which is actually very soothing, yeah? Or maybe if we're feeling stressed or upset and we go for a walk. Actually, walking also is quite soothing, isn't it? You sort of just go and walk and there's something about that rhythm that's quite warm. Or maybe you're feeling very stressed and tense in your shoulders and your back, and you go and have a massage, and so you sort of lie there, and again, there's that kind of gentle rhythm, and it's sort of rubbing all of the tension away. Yeah. So there's something about how we are and how we work which becomes soothed by that kind of gentle rhythm. Now, do we have to actually teach the baby to make yourself pay attention to the rocking sensation, so that you can be soothed by your mummy? No, baby, don't pay attention to anything else. Make yourself pay attention to the rocking and then you'll be peaceful. Right? Or you know, if you having a massage, yeah, you lie down there at the end of a day, oh, my shoulder's so sore, and you have a massage. Do you have to say, you know, make myself pay attention to the relaxing feeling of the massage? Of course not, yeah. It's just that rhythm calms us down, soothes us. That is what the breath is doing all the time. Your breath is soothing you all the time. It wants to soothe you. That's its job, yeah. You don't believe me? Fine, stop breathing. Right? What happens if you stop breathing, yeah? Well, for a couple of seconds, it's all right. After a few seconds, you start to get a bit nervous. And then breath starts to get tight. And then you hit this panic, don't you? Yeah, when you can't breathe for like a minute or so, you get this kind of panic. And mind has to breathe. That's what happens when that breath is not soothing you anymore. Yeah? The breath wants to calm you down. So let it. Yeah? You don't have to go hunting the breath. You don't have to go focusing on it. You don't have to make yourself pay attention to the breath. Let the breath soothe you. Imagine that your meditation's like it's at the end of a hot day in Perth, and it's a hot summer's day, and you've been working really hard, and it's really stressful at the office, and then when you come home, instead of going home directly, you take a detour to go down and sit go to the beach or go by the river, and you just find a quiet place and you sit there, and the sun's just gone down and it's just starting to cool, and there's a very, very gentle breeze, hardly anything. And you're just sitting there on the sand. And the ocean is very, very quiet. Almost no movement on the ocean. Just a very gentle ripple. The water's coming in and out. Moon is coming up over the sea. Hang on, we're in Perth, aren't we? It goes down over the sea. Anyway, whatever, you get the point. So, and so you're kind of sitting there, and all of the troubles and the worries and so on that you had just for the day just sort of just wash off you. They just drift away. And that movement, you're just there with the waves and they're coming in, and you're just soothing and quietening as you're being there. So ask yourself, how does that work? Do you have to make yourself pay attention to those waves? Yeah? Do you have to make yourself pay attention to each wave as it comes in and goes out? Is that how you become peaceful? Yeah? Do you have to force yourself to think, I'm going to watch every wave come in and every wave go out? Are you thinking, if I'm not paying attention to one of those waves, I'm somehow missing the point? No, you don't think anything like that. You don't do anything. You just sit there. There's no method. There's no object. There's no technique. There's no trying. There's no making. There's no doing. You're just there in that peaceful place, and it makes you peaceful. Yeah? So this is what your meditation can be, if you let it. If you stop chasing it, if you stop trying to force it and try to control it. You know, my favorite part of the American Constitution. It's an excellent guide to meditation. Everyone has the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Yeah? Isn't that good? So I think this is terrific. We've all got the right to life, except, you know, there's lots of capital punishment and wars and stuff and guns and things. And we've all got the right to liberty, except for, you know, the millions of people in jails and stuff, right? So those ones don't seem to be taken all that seriously. But what is taken very seriously is the right to have to the pursuit of happiness, right? Not the right to happiness, yeah? You have the right to pursue happiness. And you only pursue things that you do not have. Yeah? You do not have the right to happiness. Because if you were happy, you'd stop pursuing. Right? So this is what you have. You have the right to pursue, to keep pursuing on and on and on every day of your life. That is what you have the right to do. You have the right to be born and to chase happiness but never find it for the rest of your life. You have the right to do that. I don't know if that's really a right, actually. It's more like a judgment or a condemnation. Yeah, but it's very accurate, isn't it? That's how life is. Our life is the pursuit of happiness. Not the happiness, but the pursuit of it. So what if we were to stop pursuing? What if we were to let happiness just come to us? What if we were to stop thinking of happiness, which is something out there? Again, notice how this object, right, this thing out there that we have to pursue and catch, because happiness is different from us. That's why we have to pursue it. The third thing, you know, in this was way I'm talking about meditation. You know, you have the me in here, which is somehow separate from an object there, and then you have the thoughts. And it's very curious how when you're meditating, it's very easy, almost automatic, to perceive the thoughts as being something external, right? That you sit there. You're trying to watch, and then somehow the thoughts, people use this language when they're talking about it. Again, language can be very revealing. So they say, you know, the thoughts keep coming in. Yeah? Oh, I kept being interrupted by thoughts. And so it's almost as if the thoughts are another person, right? There's something outside you. Yeah, so you're sitting there, and often we do that in meditation, don't we? We sit there and we have like conversations or arguments and so on and so forth. And so it's this idea that thoughts are separate from who we are, and they keep on coming in and annoying us, which gets it's a little bit worrying, isn't it? Because when you start to realize actually it's just you, you're all alone, you're sitting there. All of those thoughts are coming in. There's nobody there. It's just you. So why do we experience these thoughts as outside? Why does it feel like those thoughts are not me? Well, this is what in psychology they call integration, right? So integration simply means that all the different parts of your mind and who you are kind of working together. They're all communicating and integrated, I guess, right? So when parts of your psyche are not integrated, right? So when there are parts of who you are that you don't like, that you don't want, right? That you reject, then you sort of shove them outside. You try to put them into another room and close the door and hope that they're going to stay there. And then they come, they speak and they say things. This is why we experience those voices as suffering. Yeah. We actually don't want to be hearing those voices because those voices are part of ourselves that we don't really accept, that we don't really love. And so we find those voices to be annoying. There's this kind of irritation, this kind of grit to them. If only those voices could be silent. If only they just shut up. And so we keep on trying to push those voices outside as if we're trying to push part of ourselves away because part of us we don't like. And actually that part of us who we don't like is often a fairly large part, actually. It's often, well, most of it. So rather than trying to push all those things away, what if we were to invite them all in? What if we were to say, you know, that these voices are like unpleasant relatives, right? Who we find kind of annoying and irritating, and we'd rather actually, but actually they're family. So you can't, well, there's not much you can do, is there? So you're sitting there meditating, you hear a ring on the door. Oh, I want to just be peaceful in my meditation. Oh, it's angry Aunt Sally at the door. I'm just going to sit here and meditate and hopefully she'll go away. But she doesn't. She keeps ringing the doorbell again and again and again. And next time you meditate, she comes back. And the next time you meditate, angry Aunt Sally is there. So what do you do? Okay, you go answer the door. You say, please come in, Aunt Sally. So good to see you. I haven't seen you in such a long time. Please come in, sit down, have a cup of tea. And angry Aunt Sally's very angry. And she'll say, what are you doing? That tea's not good enough. This is, You don't have to do anything, right? There's no real Aunt Sally. You're just making this up, okay? But you just accept, you just love anyway, you just forgive, whatever. Yeah. And then Uncle Bob comes and everybody, all the other relatives who you really never want to see, they all come to the door and they all have their own problems and their own issues and so on. And you just invite them all in. Come, join me. Be part of me. Let me listen to your story. What happens when, if you're thinking in your family, you know, with your kids or whatever, that they have some kind of problem, they have some kind of suffering, and they want to talk to you about it, you know, Mum, this happened to me, or Dad, this happened to me, or something, and you just say, shut up, kid, stop annoying me, get out of here, right? it wants to keep coming up. They have something to say, yeah? So you listen. Oh, okay. You listen. You don't have to do anything else, usually, right? It's just to have that attitude of compassion and loving and kindness. You listen, you let that in. Oh, okay. And that's enough, right? Then that energy is then released. if those parts of your mind, those parts of your mind which are not integrated, they're locked away, right? They feel like they're being listened to. They feel like they're being accepted. They feel like they're being loved. And when they feel like that, they're not going to be so worried. They're not going to be so tense. They'll gradually quieten down. They're not going to quieten down because you tell them to be quiet. They quieten down because they don't have anything to be noisy about. They don't have anything to be angry about. You know, what do you do? I'm sure most of you probably have much more experience with this than I do, but what do you do with, how do you get children to be quiet, right? Do you know, children are running around being noisy. What do? Do you tell them, shut up, kid? Sit down, shut up, be quiet. Well, in the old days, you could do that, right? These days, you give them an iPad, yeah? Problem solved, yeah? Okay, so you cause developmental issues or whatever, then that's a problem in the future. But for the moment, anyway, problem solved, right? Why are they quiet, right, when they're playing with the iPad? Because they're having fun, because they like it. Yeah, and they'll keep on doing that, and they'll keep on being quiet as long as they can, as long as you give them the chance, or until they get bored, until it's not fun anymore. So it's the same thing with your meditation. You'll never be quiet in your meditation by telling your mind to shut up, by locking things out of your mind, by pushing them away, by concentrating, by making yourself pay attention, by working at a meditation object. If you want to be quiet, the only way that you'll find quietness and peace in your meditation is when all the parts of who you are feel accepted, when they all feel understood, when they all feel loved. If you go the other way, if you try to sort of make yourself pay attention and so on, at the most, what you can do is you can get a brittle temporary silence, right? So it's the same as, like, you know, you can tell your kids to sit down and shut up, and you can control everything, and for you might get a few minutes of quiet and peace, right? But it's a fairly brittle peace, right? You're still tense because you know at any minute it's going to it's going to all kind of erupt again. So you get a few minutes. I mean, and so sometimes we can think, oh, okay, meditation's working because, you know, at least I got those few minutes of peace. Yeah. So this is a kind of stillness of mind that Buddha called a stillness which is forcibly held in place by restraints. Okay, so it is a kind of stillness, but it's not really a deep kind of stillness. It's not proper samadhi. It's very short term, it's very brittle, and it doesn't create a deep sense of peace. So rather than thinking about, you know, how can I get rid of thoughts and make myself quiet, we think, how can I be peaceful with all of these things? How can I accept all of those things in? And then let them find their own peace, let them find their own quiet. I found a wonderful analogy for this process when I was reading one time about the medieval Hindu controversies on aesthetic theory. Okay, now this is probably not something which most of you have been deeply concerned with in the past, but in Indian aesthetic theory of different poetry and so on, then they have a theory. It's a little bit like the English ideas of, like, genres. You have drama and comedy and so on and so forth. So in the Indian theory, each work of art has a rasa, okay? A rasa is a flavor, okay? And so one of the things when you create a work of art, whether it's a poetry or a song or a painting or something, is it has to have a rasa, okay? Which might be love, it might be tragedy and so on. And one of the big problems in Indian aesthetic theory is, what is the rasa of the Mahabharata? Okay, so the Mahabharata, the greatest work of Indian literature, the greatest work of Indian art of any kind, possibly the greatest work of literature of any kind. And It's a huge thing. It's sprawling. It covers so many things, has so many stories, so many things. How can you say it has one particular flavor? And people tried to say, you know, it's a love story, or it's a story of war, or it's a story of humanity. And people, all these different theories about what was the rasa, what was the flavor of the Mahabharata. But you can never settle on anything because it's always got so many other things there that you can't say it has one particular rasa. Until finally the problem was solved by one philosopher who said that the flavor of the Mahabharata is the flavor of peace. Shantarasa, which actually is not one of the proper rasas at all, but he just made that up, okay? The Shantarasa, the flavor of peace. And if you're familiar with the Mahabharata, then you know this is completely mad, right? Mahabharata is a war story. It's full of violence. It's full of politics. It's full of betrayal and lust and all of these kinds of things that go on in the world. How can you possibly say that the flavor of the Mahabharata is the flavor of peace? And of course, the answer to that question is that that's precisely why it has the flavor of peace, because it allows all of those things to exist. It doesn't make any distinction. It doesn't filter out and judge. It doesn't say this is okay and that isn't okay. It's all of those things, all of those different aspects of life can come in and they can be accepted, and they're all just part of that story, part of that one thing. And so because it's so accepting, then it has that flavor of peace. So I thought that was a beautiful idea and a very profound understanding of the nature of what real peace is. So our minds are a little bit like the Mahabharata, aren't they? Their minds are full of wars and intrigues and betrayal. All of these things going on, and it never seems to stop. Again, another quality of the Mahabharata, it never seems to stop, right? It just keeps on going on endlessly. So your mind is like that. It keeps on coming up with new stories and ideas and so on and so on and so forth. So how do we find that peace? How do we allow all of those things to be there without making a problem out of them? So when we come to meditation, when we come to watch our breath, or whatever meditation we're doing, let's say we're watching our breath. And again, you know, these idioms, I can't help but using them. You know, we're watching our breath implies I'm in here, my breath is over there, and I have to watch it. Like I'm watching, you know, watching something, I'm watching the telly is over in the corner, or I'm watching something to make sure that, you know, make sure the kids are safe or whatever. But you know, it's not like that. You sit down there to meditate on your breath, be mindful of the breath. Let the breath come and soothe you. You think of the breath like those waves, or think of like you're a little baby, you're being held in your mum's arms and just being rocked backwards and forwards. Let the breath come and soothe you. The breath has that natural quality of peacefulness. So don't think in terms of like, how do I get this meditation object? How do I, you know, develop these different stages of meditation and all of these kinds of things? I mean, there are some things that we can learn from understanding the different stages of meditation in Buddhism. I'm not saying that it's wrong to learn and understand these things, but the point is just that a bit like that story I gave at the beginning of those people who are kind of doing the standing by the no standing sign, right? So we take them too literally, yeah? Instead of using them for what they're meant to be used for. The purpose of learning and studying and understanding about the different meditations is so that it can help us to make our mind peaceful. Right? It's not so that we can make ourselves get to every one of those stages. So if that study and reading the meditation books or hearing the different meditation teachings, if that's helping us to become more peaceful, then that's terrific. Right? But if while we're doing it, we just end up being more worried about reaching different stages and which technique is better. And sometimes people go and they put this technique and that technique. Honestly, it's all just a waste of time, really. Just be peaceful. What more is there? Why do you want to go to all different countries and different places and learn all these different methods? Just be mindful. Be peaceful. That's the only method that matters. Let the breath wants you to calm down. If you only will let it, get out of the way, stop trying to force, stop trying to control, let the breath soothe you. Let peace come to you. Okay, so that's my talk for this evening on breath meditation. I hope that's been of some interest. Okay, so I believe that our overseas persons aren't going to have any questions today because we have a technical problem. So we have questions. Do we have a question box here? No questions from the question box. So we have a microphone. Okay, Christina's got a microphone. Who has a question? One down here.
Could you please, I'm not sure if you can hear me, could you please define mindfulness? Because it's a term that often appears, and I thought I understood it, but I'm not so sure anymore.
So you want me to define mindfulness?
Please explain it.
Or define mindfulness. Okay, very good. So the question is to what does mindfulness mean? Mindfulness, again, is a very interesting example of how a particular word and the choice of a word shapes meditation and shapes meditation experience. Now, of course, the Buddha didn't use the word mindfulness, right? The Buddha used the word sati, okay? That's the ancient Indian word, or smriti in Sanskrit. And sati literally means memory, okay? So when the Buddha said anapanasati, we translate it as mindfulness of breathing. If we translate it very literally, it would be memory of breathing or remembering the breath. Okay, remembering the breath. Venerable Tanisara has a very good translation, I think, of that. He says, keeping the breath in mind. Yeah, so this idea of keeping it in mind. Just very briefly, with what happened with the English translation, it was actually invented in the 19th century. The translation mindfulness was first used by the great English Buddhist scholar Thomas Rhys Davids, and he translated sati as mindfulness. And the curious thing is, of course, Rhys Davids had never meditated. Okay, so in those days, nobody in England did meditation, right? So he's very interested in Buddhist philosophy and history and so on, but not meditation. But somehow he had this kind of intuition or idea about what sati meant, and he translated it as mindfulness, and it caught on, and then it's kind of shaped our experience of meditation since then. So mindfulness, the way that it's used in the way that's used in when the Buddha was talking about it, it definitely has that idea. The main idea it has is of continuity. Okay, so this is what memory does. So memory makes a continuity. It makes a connection between the past and the present, right? So it keeps it means that your life is not just a series of fragments, right? Life is not just a grains of sand that are disconnected from each other, but they're connected, and that connection has a meaning. So to keep something in mind, yeah, through the meditation, so you're keeping the breath in mind. Yeah? Actually, the best definition that I've seen in a Buddhist text of that was by a Sangha in his Abhidharma Samuchaya, who he defined sati as the continual bearing in mind of the previously experienced object. Okay, so what that means is that when, for example, you're watching the breath, that you keep that breath in mind, you keep the mind coming back to it. So the aspect of mindfulness as such means keeping that in mind. Yeah. Okay. Does that clarify that?
It goes slightly against my understanding so far, because my understanding was more full presence.
Uh-huh.
As in continuous looking forward, letting it go as it goes.
Notice how you're using your hands with that. You've still got this idea that mindfulness is here and all that other stuff is out there. Yeah? Mindfulness is like
that's
this.
That's what I'm explaining.
Hello, world, come. Yeah.
That used to be my understanding, so you certainly broadened my understanding.
Of it's interesting, isn't it, that we still have that it's so deeply ingrained. What the idea of full presence that you mentioned is probably closer to. I mean, these things are just words. They're all just words talking about an experience, right? So we can't be too insistent on them. But it's probably closer to what the Buddha used another word, sampajanya, which has that idea of like all-round knowing, or like clear comprehension, they often translate it as. And actually that word sampajanya is probably actually closer in meaning to what we often use the word mindfulness for in the current day, yeah. So, for example, often we use the term like mindfulness in daily life, right? So you should be mindful of whatever you're doing. But when the Buddha was talking about that, he usually used the word sampajanya rather than the word mindfulness.
So to me, yeah. This is awareness, acceptance. Mm-hmm.
Yes, yes.
So, yeah, I know they are words, but when we talk about it, we have to use words.
Yes. Yeah.
Thank you.
Otherwise, we just can grunt at each other. It doesn't get you very far. Words aren't too bad, you know. Words get a bad rap in meditation circles, but they're not too bad. It's quite amazing that we've actually been able to do that. I mean, isn't it? That we actually develop language that's subtle enough and refined enough that we can actually talk about meditation at all, right? It's not surprising that we can't talk about it perfectly. It's surprising that we can talk about it at all, that we can actually talk about our inner experiences in a way that kind of makes sense. And I know from experience as a meditation teacher that, of course, when I'm saying these things, you know, there's all these people in this room and everybody will understand it slightly differently. Yeah? Words aren't neutral. Words are a connection between one person, the speaker, and another person, the listener. And each listener will interpret those things slightly differently. So in other words, don't blame me if it doesn't work. That's what I'm trying to get at. Yes?
Bhante, a question to ask is, when I meditate, it's like slowly I get to attach to peacefulness.
Mm-hmm.
So just maybe I need some advice, because sometimes when I be peaceful and then when there are some thoughts coming up, just feel a bit disturbed.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm.
So my experience was slowly going meditate and then slowly attach to peacefulness.
Mm.
So I need some advice.
Sure. So again, notice that use of language you mentioned there, as you said, the thoughts coming up. Yeah? So as if the thoughts are somehow independent from you. Yeah? But the thoughts aren't something independent from you. Thoughts are something that you are doing. Right? So if we think about it that way, so instead of saying, I get peaceful in my meditation and then some thoughts come up and I find that's disturbing or annoying, we say, I'm sitting in meditation, peace happens, yeah, but then I start doing things. Yeah, I start thinking. And when I start thinking, I realize, oh, that peacefulness is not there anymore. Yeah, you see, it's a slightly different way of thinking about the meditation, of describing it. So if we recognize that, then what happens, and what you'll see often happens in meditation, is that as your mind becomes more peaceful, right, it's not just that thinking happens, it's not just that you think, but that the nature of those thoughts changes, okay? Because they're your thoughts happening in your mind. Your mind is changing during the meditation. Most of the time, the mind is becoming more peaceful, the various defilements and hindrances are settling down and becoming quiet, and so the thoughts will tend to be more better thoughts, more clear, or more insightful. Perhaps it'll be like answers to problems they've been worried about and so on. Not always, because the mind's tricky and complicated, right? Sometimes it'll be the opposite. But that's just overall, that's the tendency. But generally speaking, what happens is as you settle down deeper into the meditation, the thoughts come from deeper parts of your own mind, okay? And that's why you keep on feeling them as something which is objective to you. Oh, the thoughts come up, yeah? there's something outside of your experience. It's not me thinking them, because it's something that's a bit new, it's a bit different. Okay? So just accept them. Instead of thinking, oh, this thought is disturbing me, you think to yourself, ah, when I act in that way, that's teaching me something about myself that I didn't know before. Yeah? Ah, I can learn from that thought. Yeah? Now, that doesn't mean you get caught up in the thought, right? It doesn't mean you start following it along, right, and pursuing it. But it means you say, oh, I didn't know I was interested in that. Oh, I didn't know that was still worrying me after all these years. Yeah? Oh, I didn't know that I, you know, liked raspberry ice cream so much. Yeah? So all of these, where are these thoughts coming? What do they, you can just sort of reflect on it. Oh, okay, that's actually the fact that you're doing something in that moment is telling you something about yourself. And again, you don't have to make a big deal about it. These things happen all the time. But you just say, oh, okay. And then come back to the meditation. So if you think about it as something which is showing you something rather than something which is disturbing your peace, yeah, again, this idea that I'm here and I'm peaceful and these things are outside and they want to disturb my peace, yeah, you think, oh, okay, I'm learning something from that. All right. That's why the peace is valuable, right? Because you can learn more about yourself.
Sadhu, Bhante.
Okay.
In recent times, I've become excellent at falling asleep very quickly.
Uh-huh. Congratulations.
And it's a bit boring. Many
people struggle with that for their whole lives. That's excellent.
Help.
Help. What do you mean when you meditate, you fall asleep?
When I meditate, yeah. I mean, even when I'm totally alert, when I start in about 10, 15 minutes, I'm so relaxed, and then, oh, this is so nice, and then off I go. I start dreaming, and then I wake up eventually, and then, oh, okay, here we go again. And then I dream again. And
well, at least you're not trying too hard. It's better to be falling asleep than be giving yourself a headache, so that's something. When sometimes, okay, there's different patterns that we get into with falling asleep in meditation. Sometimes we're just tired, right? And often there's like a program. My mind's a program that when we stop doing stuff, we fall asleep, yeah, because we're just kind of a bit exhausted. So if that's happening, that's not such a big deal, right? And you're a bit tired and you fall asleep now and then, and so you just be patient and it'll be okay. But then sometimes what can happen is that we can get into more of a habit where we're like conditioning our mind that meditation time means sleepy time. Yeah? And so that can be something which is quite hard to break out of. Yeah? So what I would suggest with that one, the first thing to do is short meditations. Right, so you mentioned after how many, 10, 15 minutes? Yeah, the mind will start to close down. Okay, so meditate less than that. Yeah, just meditate for 5 minutes. Yeah, meditate for 5 minutes, have a nice clear meditation, then stand up, okay, do what you're doing, and then come back and meditate for another 5 minutes. Yeah, and you do that for a while and let that condition you so that your conditioning is that meditation is the time that I'm awake. Yeah, and so you do that for a few weeks and then maybe try extending it to 10 minutes. Yeah, don't be in a hurry, and gradually extend it to 10 minutes. You can do lots of short 5-minute meditations. You don't have to meditate less, but just meditate in shorter bits. Yeah, so then come meditate for 10 minutes. And if you're finding that your mind is still wanting to shut down, then what you can do is just when you notice, if you're sitting and you notice at that point when the mind is starting to shut down, yeah, then just stand up. Right? Don't mess around with it. Don't complain. Don't try to fight or anything. Just stand up. Don't do anything. Just stand there. And then wait for the feeling of tiredness to go away. Yeah. If it does, if it doesn't, then just, you know, go and do something else until the feeling's gone. But normally if you stand up, you know, for a few minutes, that feeling might calm and then it go away. And when it's gone away, just sit down again. And then if it comes up again, then you just stand up. Yeah. And do that as often as it takes. Yeah, that way you're breaking that habit, you're breaking that conditioning. so that your mind knows that it's not going to get away with it. Right? So try that.
I wanted to let you have your water.
Oh, please, no, go ahead. Yeah.
What I wanted to ask was similar to that. You kind of answered it with the standing up comment. I find when I try to meditate, my biggest thing is physical discomfort. Mm-hmm. And I know, as you said, it's me thinking these thoughts. It's me making myself more aware of the physical discomfort.
And it's you trying as well.
And it almost seems the harder I try, the worse it gets.
As Yoda said, do or do not, there is no try.
Even just before when we were sitting here meditating, I think I moved about 50 times all uh-huh. up. And I kept thinking, oh, I hope I'm not disturbing other people, but okay. I can't seem to get my mind away from it.
Okay, so there's that physical discomfort, okay? So the first thing is that the fact that you're experiencing that physical discomfort is not a bad thing, right? What it means is that you're becoming more aware. Yeah, I mean, you notice how when you know, if you're sitting in meditation and you just get a little itch or something like that, and it just becomes this nightmare, right? Well, why is that? Well, it's because you're more conscious. That's the whole point of meditation, is to become more aware. So, of course, everything is experienced more vividly. Sounds are experienced so vividly, yeah? I don't know if you've ever had the experience where if you've got like a watch or a clock or something and you've misplaced it and you need to find it again, best way is to just go and sit meditation, yeah? And then after 5 or 10 minutes, you can hear it, tick, tick, tick. Ah, okay, that's where it is. It's an excellent method for finding watches. Yeah. Also, solving crosswords, very good. Yeah, I have a friend in Sydney who taught his dad to meditate, and he said he asked his dad, how's the meditation going? And he said, oh, it's really good. It really helps me with my crosswords. So whenever he comes to an answer that he can't get, then he'll go and sit in meditation. Ah, there's the answer. That's what the Buddha said, yeah? Your mind becomes peaceful. You see things as they really are, yeah? So you see the crossword answer as it really is. Yeah, that's someone who really understands the purpose of meditation. So to come back to this, you're becoming more aware of all of those sensations. And that's not a bad thing, right? That's a good thing, actually. But it's also true that most of those sensations are a bit kind of irritating and a bit painful, anywhere from just being kind of mildly distracting to being extremely painful. So we can do ordinary physical things to try to help that. Okay, so most obvious one is to sit in a chair, right? People are very different when it comes to sitting cross-legged and sitting on the floor. Some people can do it and they're very comfortable. Others are not. So if you find that that's a problem, then just try sitting in a chair and see how that goes. Yeah. Apart from that, another thing that you can do is if you find, because sometimes what happens, sometimes it's not the physical posture so much, but it's more the intensity of our awareness, our self-consciousness of those feelings. It sounds like maybe that's more the issue here.
That kind of sounds like it could be, because I do feel that discomfort in a kind of different way than a normal physical pain. Like it's very hard to describe, but it's almost like I can't not move. Like I feel like if I don't move it, I'm going to just go crazy. Like it's like this. I'm so consciously aware of this little pain or large pain.
Yeah. Okay, well, again, a very simple thing to do with that would be to do walking meditation. Okay. Yeah, walking meditation's great. And unfortunately, we don't have enough room in here to do walking meditation now. But basically, the idea is that you have a path. It's usually about 20 paces long. When you do walking meditation, you should have a defined length of path. Okay, you don't just walk as long as you want, and you don't walk around in circles because then your mind goes around in circles. Okay, you have a defined path, and you stop at the end of it. So your mind stops at the end of it, and just walk mindfully backwards and forwards. Yeah. But again, part of it is it's not so much about, you know, you can do different meditation objects while you're doing the walking meditation. You can watch your breath, or you can just be mindful of the sensation of walking, or you can do metta, loving kindness, or whatever you want. That's fine. But the main thing about it is just, again, that soothing posture. Yeah, that when walking is just naturally soothing. I think actually we're kind of, maybe it's evolution or something. I think we're quite adapted to just walking for many hours every day. I think the human body's actually, that's what it's supposed to do, really. So walking is quite just naturally soothing. So just walking backwards and forwards. And so maybe the thing to do would be to do walking meditation until you feel quite peaceful. And maybe keep, if you can, it depends on your situation, but if you can have like a chair or something like that just next to your walking meditation path. So you walk backwards and forwards maybe for 20 minutes, half an hour, something, until you feel nice and peaceful. And then just sit down on the chair and meditate just for 5 minutes. Yeah? Make it more, until you feel peaceful, and then if you want to do more walking meditation, then you can do more walking meditation. So you do that until you feel really comfortable with that feeling of sitting. Yeah, and let that peacefulness lead you, rather than letting, because often what happens is we let our desire to meditate lead us. I want to be able to sit. I want to be able, and so our desire is out there, and we're back here, and we're still pursuing happiness, right? And we're pursuing this idea. So, but let your peacefulness lead you. Yeah. So you just, I'm feeling peaceful for that 5 minutes. Oh, that's good enough. 5 minutes of being peaceful is fine. 10 minutes of being peaceful is fine, whatever it is. And then when you're feeling that agitation coming, then just get up and do some more walking. Yeah?
Thank you so much.
Okay, well, try it out and see how it goes. Okay, another one at the back here. Oh, someone.
John, speaking of words and language, if you'll excuse the pun, do you think the word dukkha directly translates to suffering in English?
Does dukkha directly translate as suffering in English? Well, I don't know about directly, but I don't think it's too bad. Yeah, I know a lot of people don't like it very much. They think suffering, they don't like talking about suffering very much. But I think it's more because people don't like talking about suffering. I've never found any particularly, I never found it particularly inappropriate. Yeah. I mean, it certainly is used in Buddhism more broadly than just sort of suffering or painful feeling, right? But I haven't come across a better one. Yeah, better translation.
I guess that's where I'm heading. Is it something more refined than physical pain? Because I presume even an enlightened being would experience physical pain.
That's right, yeah. That's right, they still suffer. Arahants still suffer.
Enlightenment's not the total absence of.
Well, no, we distinguish between the enlightenment that a person experiences in this life that we call becoming an arahant or becoming enlightened, and so then you don't have any mental suffering, right? So you don't have any stressful emotions and so on, but you still you get sick and so on, so you still feel that physical pain. But then when a person who's enlightened passes away, we call parinibbana, then they don't have any form of suffering whatsoever.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay.
I can't help but think of Wittgenstein's quote, there are no philosophical problems, but only language problems.
Uh-huh.
But I suppose where I want to go is we're talking about language and use of words. And we've used the word happiness quite a lot tonight.
Hmm.
I think, for example, the philosopher Plato would have called happiness eudaimonia, which meant human flourishing. When say, in a Buddhist context, we refer to happiness, what exactly are we trying to define? And what's the definition of happiness?
What's the definition of happiness? I don't know about definition, but... familiar with that idea. In the Greeks, they distinguish between eudaimonic happiness and hedonic happiness, yeah, which you also experience. But the word we're using in Buddhism actually would encompass both of those things. The most common word for happiness in Buddhism is sukha, which is opposed to dukkha, which is for unhappiness or suffering, right? And sukha, literally, it means basically just wellness or goodness, and suffering means badness, basically. Now, they are used in an ordinary language sense just of ordinary physical pleasure and physical pain. Okay, so that's the most basic meaning of it. They're also used in a more subtle sense for psychological pleasure and psychological pain, right? So you have a happy emotion. And that then becomes extended and becomes used for states of pleasure and happiness that you experience, say, through meditation, through practice of jhanas and so on. Interesting thing is that in the way the Buddha talked, the word happiness or sukha is so closely related to jhana that they can actually be synonyms. And the Buddha can actually use the word sukha, meaning pleasure, actually as a word for jhanas. So I'll give you an example of that. If when we do the meal offering for the Sangha, and then during the meal offering, then the Sangha will do the chant. And part of the chant is Ayuwano Sukhang Balang. Yeah? So this is like a blessing. And it's not really a blessing, but it's the idea that if you somebody who gives and has practiced generosity, then they will receive these four benefits. Ayu wano sukhang balang. Ayu means a long life, wana means beauty, sukha means happiness, and bala means strength or good health. Right? But the Buddha also gave all of those terms a spiritual definition as well as an ordinary physical definition. And so the spiritual definition, ayu, is the four, what they call the four idipadas or bases of psychic power. Wana is keeping precepts. Sukha is pleasure, is the four jhanas. Yeah? And then bala, or health, is the strength to be able to overcome all defilements and become enlightened. So in that context, the word sukha, or pleasure, is almost it's almost a synonym of the practice of the four jhanas. And so when it comes to that kind of level, and when you're looking at what the meaning of the word pleasure is in the spiritual sense, right? It's much more defined in the terms of the absence of things which cause suffering. And so the Buddha used these kinds of similes. He said the experience of the happiness in meditation is like the experience of happiness of a man who's let out of jail. Right? Now that's an interesting one, because the happiness of someone let out of jail is not exactly a feeling, is it? Right? A person who's let out of jail, different people let out of jail would have different feelings. Right, and they will actually experience pleasure or happiness maybe in different kinds of ways, which might be very complex. But there's always something in common about that, which is the release from that sense of being imprisoned, or the feeling of somebody who's become healthy after being ill. Yeah, these kinds of things.
Return to your natural state, so to speak.
Something like that, which is itself a happiness. But it's a happiness that comes from the ending of suffering. And so as you proceed and go deeper and deeper in meditation, then that happiness becomes deeper and deeper until eventually it becomes not even a pleasant feeling, because the pleasant feeling itself has a certain pull to it, so it's not completely peaceful. Right? Pleasure sort of innately makes you want to go towards it. So in some sense, a neutral feeling is more pleasant. Yeah? So this is what the Buddha is talking about, the fourth jhana and the higher jhanas, is even that neutral feeling is a deeper form of happiness than a pleasant feeling. And then beyond that, of course, then there's the letting go of all defilements, letting go of all suffering, and then that's the ultimate happiness of nibbana, the Buddha called paramang sukhang, which has nothing to do with any kind of feeling. Okay.
Thank you.
So are you happy with that answer?
I have more questions, but I'll leave it there.
Thanks very much, Eddie. That's terrific. Thank you. Yeah, that's good. Okay. If there are no more questions, any more? We have one more.
Ajahn, when trying to settle mind in a peaceful way, why always the worrying thoughts are coming rather than pressure thoughts?
So again, notice how the language you're using is exactly how I was talking about before. You're trying to be peaceful, yeah? And those thoughts coming, yeah? So what if you don't try to be peaceful? Yeah? What if you let those thoughts be worrying thoughts? Yeah? It's actually quite natural because the mind is naturally conditioned to emphasize the negative in many ways. And I think part of that is evolution, right? If you think in the most kind of basic terms, right, where here we are living in the forest or living in the jungles and we've got to try to survive, and how have we survived? Well, we hear a noise in the bushes and it's some animal there, a large animal, right? It's either a deer or a tiger, right? Now, if it's a deer, then we've got dinner. If it's a tiger, we are dinner. Yeah? Now, we can go without dinner for a night and we'll be survived. We can go without dinner for two or three nights, right? So if we mistakenly let a few deer go, we can still survive. But only one tiger and we're finished, yeah? So this is why we're always kind of, I think, alerted to, I think this is an important aspect of conditioning, evolutionary conditioning. But that's just an example, but this idea that we have to, we're sort of being conditioned to be alert to what might go wrong, yeah, to worry about things. And that's just how our mind's conditioned, that's all. So remember that that's just something that we do. We do because it's a habit. We do because it's reinforced, because ads are telling us to worry about things, because insurance companies are telling us to worry about things. Yeah? I was talking to someone who was selling insurance the other day, and they were saying, you know, they'd gone to a seminar and stuff, and that's exactly what they were told. You know, you have to make people worry about things. That's how you sell insurance. So just accept those things. Just love them. Don't try to make them go away. Yeah? Worrying mind is a mind which is suffering. So what do you do when somebody's suffering? Give them a hug. Give them a cup of tea. Give them a kind word. Yeah? And rather than trying to push them away and send them out, let them come in. Okay, that's all right. Be peaceful. Be kind. And then let those worries be worries. Don't try to push them away. Don't try to make them be something else. Yeah? That's just part of you who's just doing something at that moment. Accept that. Let it go. Let them just be peaceful. Okay?
Thank you.
All right. Okay. So I think we should probably finish up around then. So let's finish by paying respects to the Triple Gem.